His civil or street name is Guido von Arx. His spiritual name is Gauralila Dasa. Gauralila, you are now nearing 40 or about 40, is that correct?
A little more, yeah.
Just a little over the hill.
Yeah.
The wrong side of 40. And you are a living example of the problem or the challenge of living a spiritual life in a secular world. We're part of this world. It is a secular world. It has finances. It has administrations, politics, bureaucracy that we have to deal with every single day. We have to make a living in the secular world. Most of us do. And yet you try to maintain the spirituality, which is a quest that brought you all over the world, practically. You've traveled widely and so on. Let's go back to the very beginning of your quest for spirituality. At what point did you, as Guido von Arx, begin the road to what became Gauralila Dasa?
I was a hippie in my teenage days, and it was a problem for my parents, not so much for me. I had no idea what I should become. Really, there was no profession which attracted me. Parents kind of forced me to do something, so I continued school so I could push the decision just far away. And it started with a book we went through in high school, so to say, called Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, and which is a quest for spirituality of a young priest's son in India, and actually going through different phases in his life and experience different things in his life. So after reading that book, for me, the conclusion was clear: I have to go to India. Some or other, whatever is offered here to me in the West is not satisfying me, is not intriguing me, is not challenging me enough. So I made up my mind, and as soon as I finished school, and thanks to my parents, I would have to say in a little bit ironical way, I did an apprenticeship for 2 years at the post office, knowing from day one that I wouldn't stay there. I can't be a clerk, just can't live between paragraphs and decisions made by these kind of people there. So after finishing the school and that apprenticeship, I left Switzerland, and it was supposed to become a world tour. But after entering India, we traveled among our friends, we were five of us, through the countryside, through the land side, so to say, to India, not by airplane, going through Afghanistan and these countries. So I'm crossing the border of India, it just became clear to me, I feel home here. And indeed, India became my second home.
I just want to interrupt you for a moment, because for those who are not aware, Hermann Hesse is one of the great and favorite German language writers. Of course, his works have been translated into many other languages as well. But we have to bring this into context, because you're a German Swiss, you're in the German-speaking world, and there are so many people in the German-speaking world who have begun their spiritual quest thanks to Hermann Hesse, because he really was a pioneer in that respect, at least in the German-speaking world, would you agree?
Yes, actually, he was able to kind of address the desires, the needs, the longings of the young people, you know, beginning of the 20th century, and his books became a big challenge for the mainstream world, but especially a big attraction for younger people who wanted more than just plain old living, maybe the way the parents did.
What was his recipe for successful coexistence with the spiritual and the secular?
As a writer and as a poet, he, of course, expressed all his desires and longings through the pen. And he was a thinker, an intellectual personality. For him, it was just obvious, having searched for his own purpose in life, and even in the beginning, his own dharma in life, so to say, his work in life, that he opened up different paths to see what is right or wrong for him. Although at the age of 13, he came to the conclusion, I'll be either a writer or nothing. But his parents didn't agree so much, or they wanted him to become a priest and maybe a missionary, or he did different apprenticeships or did different kind of works. But that was his longing. So I can't say too much about his internal attitude, but the way he expressed himself was obvious. He was a writer. He knew how to express, you know, everything which people go through in life through the communication of words. On the other hand, it was obvious that he's a searcher. How far he was able to really conclude or come to a goal or to a successful end in his searching is hard to say. In Siddhartha, in that book I was mentioning before, there is a kind of a conclusion, which is more like a Buddhistic conclusion, that you realize the oneness of everything and in this way attain peace.
Someone put it this way: when I look around, I see God everywhere, in everything. That's where he was.
I don't know whether he was there, but he expressed that through his books.
He seemed to be aware of it anyway.
He seemed to have two sides as well, this intellectual side, this spiritual side, but also he had strong desires within this material world as well. So how to manage the two is, of course, a challenge for everyone, not just Hermann Hesse. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Dharma a moment ago, and that's another subject which will appear on the list here of subjects to listen to. And that word is Dharma. And your specialty, we could mention at this point, is Dharma counseling. This is something you've done now for several years. Dharma, just to recall, it has different meanings, doesn't it? In the purpose of life, one's devotion or dedication, or the calling in life, all of these things are appropriate. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit complicated, but when it comes to a human being's Dharma, which means, what is he meant for? What is his purpose in life, as you mentioned before, which certainly isn't easy for many people. We are more here, most of us feel, at least at one point in the life, that life is more than just working and eating and sleeping and then ultimately dying. But what else is there? And I think what we all have in common all over the world is that we want to be happy. However, how to reach that happiness, there are many different ideas. And those who are spiritually inclined, they want to include that element. And for them, it's obvious or sure that without that spiritual element, you cannot be completely happy, even though you might have everything, fame, money, wealth, health, somehow or other, something is missing. And that's the desires of the souls have not been recognized or have not been satisfied. Maybe the desires of the senses have been satisfied, or of the mind, or of the emotional desires, but there is another element as well, and that's called the holistic or the complete satisfaction, where you want to use all elements.
A very important point we have to dwell on for a moment. There may be a conception, or possibly a misconception, that to attain any kind of spiritual development, we must abandon the secular, we must turn our back on the material world. We've all heard this folklore. It's even in so-called mainstream religions. Saint Francis throwing away his clothes and giving up all of his worldly possessions is, of course, in Roman Catholicism, a great example of this. But is this really necessary? In other words, my question to you is, how much spirituality and giving up of the material is necessary to find a successful mix in your personal life between the spiritual and the secular? Can we really successfully accommodate both needs?
It's possible. Just coming back to the original question you asked in that context, ultimately it's not externally how much you give up. There is a warning in the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of my main subject matters, where Krishna says, if you externally renounce things but internally remain attached, then actually you're a cheater. And ultimately it is the internal detachment that is required. When you talk about living spiritually in a secular world, then I would say externally, most probably, the spiritualists live a very similar life than the so-called materialist. Internally, however, there's a huge difference. The detachment from sense gratification, the attachment to have pride, egoistic desires are away, should be away, and an attachment for the spiritual development, for the Lord, for Krishna, is manifesting. So these are these two elements: an internal detachment from external satisfaction, pride, and arrogant desires, and the internal attachment to the Lord and his guidance.
Could I try to give this possible analogy and see how it works? Depending on what country you're in, certainly in a Western civilization like in Europe or North America or elsewhere where there's a high degree of industrialization and material development, to put it that way, we might find ourselves truly in need of a car to get around. There's nothing wrong, I'm trying to be interpretive here. There's nothing wrong with having a car to get around, to do what you have to do. The problem begins when you start looking at more than just the transportation. It's got to be this model. It's got to be a Ferrari. It has to be a Rolls Royce. This is where the problems begin. It's not the car itself which is the problem. That would be false renunciation of materialism and saying, in Australia, in the middle of the desert, I don't need a car, I'll walk all the way. I mean, that's not really very reasonable. But what you're saying is, get something that'll take care of your needs, but don't overdo it. Don't let the passion for the machine, for attaining the prestigious brand name or something, that's where you lose your spirituality and become excessively secular. Is this a fair analogy?
Yeah, matter, whether it's a car or whether it's money or anything, even our
house
our own body is neutral in one sense. It becomes materialistic if the identification is very strong, the attachment is very strong. So if someone, as you mentioned it before, in a detached way, uses that vehicle in order to move along to, you know, as a transport element in order to go from point A to B, living in the deserts of Australia where the distance are too huge to do it on foot, unless you're an Aboriginal and have sufficient time, that's fine. But ultimately, we always have to check how much attached we are or question ourselves if we lose it, if we don't have that facility anymore, that comfort anymore, how will it be? Do we get in anxiety? Are we really frustrated? Then we know there's something wrong. We have to know that one day we have to give up everything. And the last challenge we have is when we have to give up our own physical body. So the question is ultimately this attachment is one of the biggest thing in this world, that we become naturally, so to say, attached to material things because we have been born in this physical body and everyone identifies with that physical body. We feel pain when the body feels pain. We feel satisfaction when the body gets satisfaction. We think that's all there is. And actually only through intellectual understanding and spiritual guidance, you'll be able to understand there's something more, there's something beyond this physical body. And that's where actually spiritual life starts.
We've all heard this in different ways. The more you own, the more troubles you have. What you don't own doesn't cause you trouble. This is all basic wisdom.
It is said in India that a beggar can be more materialistic than a king. It's not so much the question of what you have, but how much you identify with and how much you're attached. Yeah. If a beggar is, you know, attached to his few pennies or dirty, worn-out clothes, and the king is kind of selfless and detached, then the question could very well be raised, who is more attached, the beggar or the king?
Now, in the materialistic world, in the highly industrialized countries, we have basic moral questions that have been raised often, and they continue to be raised. How much is enough? You're starting to develop this idea, but we're getting into deeper philosophy now. How much is enough? Is it acceptable for someone to fly first class instead of economy? Is it acceptable to have a convertible car instead of an old basic economy car? I mean, this is difficult for some people to define. It's one of the difficult things, really, and I suppose you have to somehow look inside for those answers. I mean, how would you handle that?
It's a question of individual person. If someone without, you know, like spending his entire life to make money in order to have a special car or in order to travel first class, just has it kind of naturally without extra endeavors, he may use it, maybe for his position, maybe for his work. It's necessary. The question again is the attachment. You can be more attached flying economy class than you can be attached flying first class. What is necessary, what comes kind of conveniently and practically, you may accept as the gift of the Lord or as your previous karma, whatever it may be. But then, however you act with it, that's the main question. If you're attached to little or if you're attached too much, to many facilities, it's not a big difference. And sometimes if you have less, you may be much more attached than those who have more. But don't strive to have more. Try, and that's a main element in spiritual life, be content, be satisfied with whatever you have. And do your work, which you require in order to maintain yourself, your physical body, you have a roof, you know, an apartment to live in, have enough food to eat. That's a thing you do by the way. But ultimately, you have to know you have to give it up. You'll be dying one day. And the more you're detached from all those alluring material things, whether it's a beautiful woman, whether it's a lot of money, whether it's a very healthy body, the easier will be your passing away. So we have a lot ground to train ourselves for that detachment. And the recommendation from the Bhagavad Gita from Lord Krishna is it's easier to detach yourself from material, mundane, temporary things if you can attach yourself to the spiritual truth, embodied, in my case, through Lord Krishna, or the Lord you have in your heart or you are looking for or worshipping.
Well, this is a very important point that you're touching on now. And the basic question here is, association with spiritual things, association with spiritual people. I know for many years, when you were a functionary in the temple here in Zurich, you were actually living in the temple. And it was always a pleasure to visit you in the temple. It was a very uplifting spiritual experience. Now, because of reasons we'll discover in just a moment, you have become forced, as it were, to become more a part of the secular world, ironically, in doing spiritual service. You've written a rock opera based on Vedic literature. We'll ask you about this in a moment. So you moved out of the temple, and you receive people here in your own apartment, and you travel a lot. You deal with impresarios, you deal with musical people. In fact, I understand in the course of you're trying to get this production onto the stage, you're even dealing with a professed atheist. Now, this is heavy stuff for someone who's trying to follow a spiritual life. Tell us about this. First of all, the production and the kind of practical everyday problems you're having in maintaining this balance, this tightrope act between the spiritual and the secular.
Living in a temple was like doing an apprenticeship. You're very well protected with teachers and maybe parental guides, etc. And one day you should supposed to be grown up and stand on your own feet and apply practically what you have learned in those days of apprenticeship. So dealing with the so-called secular world is ultimately also a question of consciousness and view. Having a spiritual life or a spiritual view is even when you see so-called atheists or material or mundane things that you see the spiritual connection behind it. Give you a practical example. You see a human being. When you just look with your external senses, you see a physical body that may be attractive or less attractive. If a little bit further developed, may also be aware of the emotions the person may have. Is the person in a happy mood or in an angry mood or in a frustrated mood? You can develop even a little bit further in your consciousness and see this person is part of the entire universe with so many living entities who are not just physical bodies, but they have emotions and they have an identity, which just brings in the more metaphysical element. Mm-hmm. And if you have the so-called complete or perfect view, then you see there is also a soul, part and parcel of the Lord, behind that person, which makes that body move.
We're all connected. We're all interlinked.
Maybe. Of course, to the spiritual energy, we're not so much aware of it now, but we have that common ground, that common identity. We're all spiritual, ultimately. We have so many layers around that spiritual identity, the emotional side, the mental side, the intellectual side, the physical side, which covers the spiritual identity. But if someone who has that spiritual view, he sees behind that person, not just the physical body, but the spirit soul, and that connection you mentioned, that is part and parcel of the universe and ultimately of the Lord. And that is a spiritual view, which is the only way, I would say, you can live spiritually in a physical world, that ultimately you lose that view that this is just a physical body or just a physical world or just a bad world. It's the world, it's the energy, it's an energy of the Lord. And don't go so much into these dualities, good and bad and good, then you're ultimately or unlimitedly, you're always bewildered by these dualities. You have to go beyond that, which is an art. Sometimes it's easier when the mode of goodness, as it is called, is more developed in a person. It's more easier to see the spiritual side behind the person when it's more covered. Then you also might identify with that coveredness more, or destructive element, or ignorant element more, and then you might just see the physical, the mundane side of it. But there it's maybe a bit more difficult, but the ultimate challenge is there. You talked about the so-called atheist, that behind the atheist you see someone who's a spirit soul, who's actually also looking for happiness, maybe thinks through religious identification or practice he can get it, but ultimately he is spiritual, he's part and parcel of the Lord. In his own way he's trying to get further. Now he's, you know, involved in studying Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic texts of India, which give him also a approach to that element, and who knows what will happen at the end. Maybe he's becoming a theist and I become an atheist. You never know.
Well, we talked about Dharma. I mean, it's conceivable that among many things that you're accomplishing with this project of yours, it could be simply to acquaint this individual with the nature of God, the universe, and it might turn him around. You're not proselytizing, you're not a missionary, but in an innocent, gentle, almost automatic way, this could very well happen. Something could just click inside him, and you're the catalyst that was supposed to come into his life to make that happen.
Just an instrument. Ultimately, the perfection is that you can be an instrument in the hands of God. And we don't know what's happened. What all we can do, and that's also an aspect of Dharma, we can try our very best. That's under our control, the best endeavor. The outcome, the result, is not under the control. Whether this person or another person or many persons will be changed, touched by an element or an endeavor like that, time will show. I don't know.
Well, we take one personality. Of course, there are many spiritual personalities who are well known, but Sri Prabhupada, for example, was the spiritual leader of the Hare Krishna movement. And he was a highly developed soul, of course, but he had this mission, and that it was to bring the Vedic message to the West. There were others, contemporaries, who did it in different ways, but let's stick with him for a moment. If we talk about finding the purpose or finding the balance between a secular and spiritual life, it seems from what you've said, and using the example of some spiritual leaders like Prabhupada, that Dharma, again, that word, that purpose, has a lot to do with it. If you open yourself and say, what is my mission? What would you like me to do? And the answer is write a rock opera, or take the message to the West, or do a radio show, or whatever. If it's spiritually motivated, you have no problem existing. Maybe you might have problems, but it's not as difficult to exist in the secular world, because it's the secular world you have to bring these messages to, if you follow my reasoning.
Yes, but even if I'm not able to make a rock opera or something like that, which could bring the spiritual cultural knowledge of the Vedic tradition to more people in the West, my purpose is ultimately to see the spiritual qualities of everything I'm doing, whether I'm acting as a so-called mundane English teacher or a journalist or whatever. The consciousness is ultimately relevant and important. All I can do is try, and I'm trying different things, and the rock opera is one of it, which is of course the most challenging and most ambitious project I'm working on, but also have to be able to carry on with my life, both physical and spiritual, if that wouldn't succeed. There's no guarantee for it. According to the statistics, it's like with Hollywood films. 8 out of 10 are a failure. Musical is more or less the same thing. And we're trying to do a non-conventional, spiritual, but mainstream musical, which certainly is a big challenge. But as I said before, what counts ultimately is my spiritual view of the whole thing, not the success or not the failure of it.
Just for the record, what's the latest working title now for the production? It has changed once or twice.
Yeah, it's just now called The Musical Based on the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. We just keep it open till the complete script is finished, until we discuss everything with the marketing company, mm-hmm. which title suits the best.
You've been involved in this for a long time. I know you and I go back a ways together too. So I've also been able to witness this developing. It takes incredible stamina, perseverance. You've been at this now for years and years. And completely,
8 years, yeah.
Yeah, devoting yourself to this. And in the course of these 8 years, and you're still not at the goal yet, it's still not on stage yet, you've had to do a lot of things. You've had to deal with all kinds of people. We talked about this a moment ago. You've come into really real life difficult situations. You've had to go, I presume, for example, to cocktail parties where all kinds of meat eating was going on, alcoholic beverages were being drunk, maybe womanizing was going on, the things that you yourself have tried in a spiritual life to avoid, and then you're thrust right in the midst of it. I'm sure this, I mean, knowing the nature of show business, you couldn't avoid that. But what did you do? How did you cope with that?
It's again there. If I'm spiritual, I'm neither attached to these things, nor do I feel an aggression towards these things. Then I'm just above. I'm not interested, but I understand that for these people, maybe it's part of their life.
You're not judgmental, I guess we could say. Avoid judgment.
That's their life. That's their responsibility. And one part of my life, I took those things as well. Now I'm trying to develop something else. And the main element is that I should be neither attached nor in a negative way towards it, because that's just the same coin, just the opposite side. So for me, that's the ultimate challenge of spiritual life, that I can be among these people and not be affected by it, and also not think that they're less than me.
A word that comes up very often in mainstream religion, temptation. The devil tempts us. How do you know if you're being tempted away from a spiritual path?
I know whether I still want to continue with my goals, which are to develop as a human being, a sensitive human being with empathy, and also spiritually, that I consider that one day I have to die and I have to finish the business here as much as possible in the material world, and that I'm philosophically, theologically, and spiritually more attached for that element. I wouldn't say that I'm not tempted. There are a couple of things in this world where I feel weakness, where I feel attracted to. However, I also know that that's one part of it. There's also another part of it is a spiritual growth. And I don't deny those elements. It wouldn't bring me much if I just kind of force myself, but still there's a desire there. I try to live it out, but not in a destructive element, but in a constructive element that I can see as much as possible, even in those things which I might like, the spiritual element of it.
And so it's not necessary to avoid all contact with secular people and secular institutions. It's just having enough strength or conviction about your own set of values that will, in a way, immunize you from, let's say, undue influence, negative influence from these things.
I like people. I like social life. I like to mix with people. However, I also like to develop spiritually. So it's a combination of both. It's part of my nature. I always have been around with a lot of different people and in the show business and meeting those people. So my challenge is not to be attached to them.
So you can do both. You don't have to closet yourself in, avoid all contact with the material and secular world, but you have to constantly be aware of cultivating your spiritual self. And if that's healthy, you're immune to the rest and you can deal with it effectively.
Yeah, just one has to be a little bit careful. The challenge or the allurement is, of course, always there. There are many things which are very attractive in this world. Whether it is for a man, maybe beautiful women, maybe fame, maybe money, all these things are there. One has to be aware of it. However, I could see in my case, it doesn't help me if I'm just living a life in seclusion. I should meet these people. I should have contact with those elements, but not to be attached and see the spiritual element behind it, and also understand that ultimately it's temporary, but what is not temporary is my spiritual growth.
Living a spiritual life in a secular world, no patented recipe. It's a challenge that each of us has to come to terms with, but it can be done.
Every day and actually every second.
Gauri Leela Dasa, thank you very much.
Most welcome.